In this episode of Entrepreneur Perspectives, we feature Caroline Alanthus. Caroline is a novelist, blogger, and freelance writer and editor. Most of her work revolves around science and fiction. She's the author of three novels, To Give a Rose, Ecological Memory, and her new novel, Bifurcation Events. I will now read for you the blurb for Bifurcation Events. There are moments that divide life into before and after. Death can do it. Any disaster can, but so can miracles. So can love. Andy, a scientist, calls these moments bifurcation events, a technical term that may or may not apply literally. He's seen his share most dramatically in the complete collapse of the civilization of his youth and the beginnings of another. His story, or part of it, was told in the novel Ecological Memory. Here are the related stories of some of his family and friends. One novel, two novellas, five short stories. Bifurcation Events. This podcast exists because of the team at CASCM. At CASCM, we make content creation enjoyable. We are on a mission to help leaders create content, content that will improve lives, content to be proud of, content that fosters community. We know through firsthand experience how content brings people together, and we love helping make that happen. We produce podcasts, short-form videos, blog posts, and other written works, while also providing support in website development, social media management, and strategic planning. And we would be excited to help you. Visit CASCM.com to learn more, or feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn or Twitter. The last time we spoke, you gave us all permission to write badly. You wrote about it as well, and it's on one of our sites. Mm-hmm. And I've heard a lot of people talk about it, right? I've heard a lot of people say, just journal. Just start writing. You don't have to write for an audience, write for yourself, but just write. It helps you think. It's all these things. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of advice, someone like yourself who's a writer, who's a novelist, who's an editor, it just helps. I'm going to leave it at that. Anyway, I was just thinking, and maybe we'll get to this point, but what other simple advice? Because I use the word advice loosely because we all get to certain things at some point in our lives, perhaps that like work for us or maybe work for somebody else. But is there anything else that comes to mind after you maybe finished this massive project of your new novel that's released, Bifurcation Events, that comes to mind to say, here's what I would maybe tell myself going back to the beginning, or what I would tell someone else who's writing? Something simple that just maybe I come back on here in a year from now and say, you know, that piece of advice you gave us on that last episode, that was also really good.
Trust the work. And I'll explain what that means. From hearing other writers talk about their work and hearing readers talk about what they read and English teachers and everything, it's really easy to get this impression that writers decide what the book is about and then they write that. And in my experience, that's not true. And I'm getting better and better at recognizing that, but I still waste so much time and energy fighting with my books. I mean, like, this book, it was supposed to be one novel, like one sequel to the previous one is going to be about certain things, and okay. And it just did not want to do it. And I started writing this before the last one was published. You know, so that was like 5 or 6 years ago now. And it fought me. It just did not want to do that. And I spent years trying to get it to behave, and it just wouldn't. And eventually, I just, okay, book, what do you want to be? Do you want me to just not write you? Is that what the deal is? Mm. What are we doing here? Whatever you want to do, I'm going to do, but you got to let me know. So it's, well, I really want to be much smaller. Oh, okay. Can I add some other things too? Can I put other things in the book besides you, the story? Yeah, that's fine. Okay. So that's what I did. And they ended up all thematically related. And supporting each other and with these great characters. And that keeps happening with my work. Yeah, I have one idea for how it's going to be, and it ends up being something completely different. The way my writing process works, I have to write something before I find out what it's about, usually. I go into it with an idea, and that's just wrong. I write the thing, and then I read it, and then I write an outline, and then I rewrite it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, trust the work.
Sounds like you have a relationship with your book, with your writing.
Yeah.
Like, you're having a conversation with it. Like, at least you were here, but it sounds like that's what you were doing then. Yeah.
Yeah, as a writer, I do a lot of listening to what I'm writing.
Yeah.
That's not what you learn in English class, or at least it's not what I learned in English class.
No, it's not. And we talked about that a little bit. That's a big one.
Yeah, I remember you talking about your English class.
Yeah. There's a few directions I can go right now. And I read your blog on outlines. And it sounds like, and you just talked about it, where your outline becomes almost like your recap of what you just wrote. It brings you up to speed on what did I just write?
Yeah.
And it's a good reference point maybe for yourself to say, where am I in the story? Because it could have been 100 pages long so far. That's a lot to go back to, like, wait, what happened on page 26, right?
Right.
And it's not what, like you just said, it's not what you learn in English class.
No.
But it's what we learn from listening and talking to you or reading your blogs.
Well, you know, in fairness to English class, to English teachers, every writer has their own process.
Yeah.
And I don't know how many people write like me. I don't think I'm the only one. But, you know, when teachers are trying to, maybe they teach their process, or maybe they teach a sort of amalgamated average that they learned from their English teacher. I don't know.
Or the district's process, right? Like, it might not even be there. It's what they're told.
Yeah. Yeah. But a teacher can't tell you how you are going to write because they don't know how you're going to write. They don't know what your process is. And I don't know if anybody else is going to use that outlining process the way I use outline. I don't know how common it is to be able to come up with these creative ideas and not be clearly aware of them until they're written down. I know at least one other writer who does that in a slightly different way, but I don't know how common it is. But the idea of trusting the work, however it is that you work, I suspect that's universal. You don't dictate to the work.
Yeah.
It takes on a life of its own, and you got to listen to it. And you got to trust it and trust that it's going to be right.
Yeah.
A friend of mine and I were talking recently about something like that. We were talking politics. Now, don't worry. I'm not going to get into the content of that. You know?
It's okay. Yeah.
But
we might get a lot more listeners if we pick a side. And
But, you know, both of us were feeling kind of anxious and depressed. And what do we do? And how do we contribute? And we both decided, we're both novelists, and we both decided that the way we can contribute is by writing novels, which sounds completely counterintuitive. How can writing about made-up stuff possibly make a difference? But it does. Mm. The big historical example was Uncle Tom's Cabin. I mean, that was fiction. And when Abraham Lincoln met the author, what he said to her was, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that started this big war." I mean, fiction can go places.
Yeah.
So that's another dimension of trusting the work. Like, if you feel something to say, say it. You know, it might be the thing that needs to be said.
Yeah. I was just having a conversation with an individual who's starting a podcast, and his podcast is about his dealing with depression, his depression. And he's having a very difficult time bringing those stories to the recording, right? This right now, which is very common, right? It's common in all forms of art, talking, writing, pictures, whatever that might be. We had this very similar conversation in how I've heard it before, and I know the impact that that might have, and it might help one person, but that might be all you need to do, right? Yeah. And you summed it up with the first three words you said on the show is trust the work. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing for him, right? And it is not easy to go through this process. It's not easy to show up and be like, wait, so you're going to ask me questions. I'm going to talk into a microphone. It's not easy to put words to paper by itself with no thought of like, oh, I'm going to publish this. And then to publish it where anyone in the world can read it. And now in a world where anyone can give you feedback, mm-hmm. whether directly or indirectly, is very challenging. And so on that alone, like you've published a lot, right? Books, blogs, mm-hmm. all sorts of content. You've been on podcasts, you've presented, you're on YouTube. I've seen those, there's videos there, right? Like, is it still hard to put those words, or are you like, is it practice? Is like the muscle just gotten stronger?
Well, writing is very different from talking for me. Mm-hmm. Because I think a little slower than most people talk. So I have these pauses when I talk vocally. I'm not slow, you know, I think well, it just takes me a while to do it.
Yeah.
So when I'm talking verbally, I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that sometimes. It takes a lot of effort to, okay, he asked a question. How am I going to figure out how to respond to that? Which things that I've already thought about can I plug in there? Oh, no, nothing. This is a totally new question. That's hard. It takes a lot of energy. And after I do an interview or something like that, you know, I have to go sit down for a while. Mm. Writing is not that difficult. And it's not stressful usually, but it's still work. You know, at the end of a day of writing, I'm tired. I'm tired. It's work.
Yeah.
And neither of them is getting easier. I am developing ways to kind of work smarter, not harder. Like when I'm interviewed by somebody I haven't talked to before, haven't talked to in a while, I don't really know how it's going to go. I'll ask them to give me questions ahead of time, and then I'll write out the answers. And then, you know, it looks like I'm speaking contemporaneously, but I'm not.
You prepared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I learned tricks like that.
Sure.
But what's hard is hard.
Yeah. Yeah. But you're right too, though. Like these conversations do take a lot out of you. I've noticed that. Even if I know what I'm going to talk about to a degree, like, but I don't, right? Because I go into it and it's like I have ideas of things I want to talk about. So it's unscripted besides like, oh, I'm going to talk to someone who just published a novel. So there's different things I want to go into as it relates to that. It's exhausting, right? Going to therapy is like, you come out, you're tired. Like you're mm-hmm. not going to go do the next hard thing, but it is tough, right? And I've seen it. It becomes easier and easier. With talking, for an example, it's like, wow, producing a podcast and listening to your voice, you're like, no one wants to hear their own voice. But once you've heard it enough times, it just becomes another voice that you've heard. So you're used to it, right? But I've seen young authors, young as far as like, they might be 70 years old and wrote their first novel, like my father, right? Mm-hmm. And that first process is like, what did they think? And there's this going through the everybody's comments matter, like it's the center of the universe. And then eventually you get to a point, you're like, I don't care, right? I'm doing this for other reasons. And it takes a while for anybody. I think we touched on this in times in our conversations of creative process. When you're a child, you just create. You come up with the wildest stuff and how amazing that is. And then one day in school, someone probably laughs at you or you get a bad grade for it or you shouldn't do that anymore. And it kind of just like puts a stop to that creative process. But I think what's cool about maybe the freelance economy, perhaps, or the creative economy, or combination of those things, is more people are being creative. And I think, I know in some regards, so I think and I know, that it's useful and it's helpful for people. And mental health is a big topic, which wasn't talked about 20 years ago like it is today, that I think being creative can help. It's like you said, it doesn't make getting on a podcast easy. It doesn't even make writing easy. Maybe it comes easier to some people, but it's still useful. I don't know what you think about that.
I don't think writing is easier for me than for other people. It may be. I don't know. I don't think I'm competent to judge myself against other people. But it's possible that I get more from my effort in terms of output. You know, it may be that I can write well when maybe somebody else can't. So in that sense, writing well might be easier or more possible or something. But the writing itself, I don't think that's easier. It's like somebody with really long legs might run faster than somebody with really short legs. But that doesn't mean that just because they're going faster doesn't mean that running's easier.
Yeah. So it's no different maybe than reading today, right? There's so many options of what we can consume, whether we read, listen, watch something, entertain ourselves in some way. You're obviously still writing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll touch on this because you brought up fiction, like these made up stories are important. They do matter. And there's a lot of nonfiction, as you know, there's a lot of nonfiction in fiction, right? There's a lot of learning. There's a lot of things that we can gather. Even like it might be in regards to places, right? They might be visiting a town and that town's real or that town's not real. And we can get into that as it relates to your book as well. And then just like wisdom or whatever that might be and connecting dots. So it is important. It does matter. I mean, people are reading, you know, because there's so much conversation about TikTok and social media and streaming and all these things are taking over, and they are. And so we have choices like that we've never had before. Where do you see it all today? Take that any direction you want.
So much.
A light topic.
Before I get into that, I remember what I was going to say. I was going to say about whether writing is easier for me or gets easier, whatever. I don't write because it's easy. I write because I can't help it. It's the main thing I can do, and it is a thing that I somehow must do. So I don't care how hard it is.
Yeah.
I'm doing it anyway.
Yeah.
As to the other, I think your chosen topic is a little too broad for me.
Yeah. Well, the way I like to do this sometimes, if you've ever heard like someone, it could be a politician or it could be a coach, let's say, and they get asked a question by someone in the press, they answer their own question of whatever they want to talk about. So I just threw at you streaming, the current state of reading, are people reading a lot, fiction, like something's going to come to mind. You can take your time with it. What's top of mind for you on that?
I mean, if I'm allowed to more or less make up my own question, you mentioned the kind of tension between reality and purely made up stuff in fiction.
Mm-hmm.
So I can take that and go somewhere with it.
Let's go.
There's usually a lot of real stuff in my fiction. Yeah, this is
your book.
A kind of a map.
Yeah.
And that's a real place. That's Long Pond on Mount Desert Island. And here are the hills around it. And I've been there many times. I've done most of those trails. Most of the main part of the book is set there. So when you're reading about, I had one of my volunteer editors say, you know, you're running a risk with these detailed descriptions of trails. You know, somebody's going to walk that trail and realize it's not accurate. Well, no, it's accurate.
Yeah.
When I say there's a rock there, that means there's a rock there. I did that.
Yeah.
And it's always interesting as a writer finding that, where do I want to depart? Where do I want to start making stuff up? What do I want to keep intact and why? And sometimes I don't know why I keep this real thing and I don't keep that real thing and so forth. But looking at it from a reader's perspective, yeah, readers can learn a lot from fiction. But I think the kind of difficult thing is figuring out what you can learn from and what you can't. Like, you can read my book and learn what visiting Long Pond is like, except that I put a public campsite there that isn't there. And I think I mentioned that somewhere, like the author's note or something, that the public campsite isn't really there. But unless I did that, you wouldn't know. Your books about historical figures, or, you know, just books about how emotions work and how relationships work. As a reader, it's easy to think that you've learned something that you haven't. And people will say, oh, it's just fiction. Really? You really think that your emotional brain knows how to tell the difference? It feels like these people are real. And the that these are examples of what real life is like, and maybe it's not. So it's just very interesting. I think writers really need to keep track of and need to be very careful about what you make up, what you don't make up, and why. You know, make sure you're not lying by accident, basically. Make sure that somebody's not going to think that something's true when it's not.
Yeah.
That's something to think about.
Yeah. There's sentences. I actually just pulled out a book I'm reading for the second time by Matt Haig, How to Stop Time.
Mm, like the title.
Yeah. He's got another book called The Midnight Library. I would recommend both of them to anybody. So there's sentences, right? I've heard this, that people remember sentences, they don't remember books, perhaps. He's talking to a student. This individual has a rare disease and he lives longer. So he ages 1 year over 15 years. Like, he was alive with Shakespeare and now he's alive living in London in modern times. So he's talking to a student of his. It just references that it's not that long ago, not really. History is right here. And when you think about that, right, like, that could inspire someone to really, like, want to learn history. I don't know. It could do all sorts of things. Or it just might be reflective to say, wow, yeah, it's so true. Like, I always think about, like, World War II really wasn't that long ago. And so that's in a book. It's a fictional book. As far as I know, that disease doesn't exist. It's not real. So he made it up and he created this world where it is real. And there's this whole there's this group of people around the world and they're looking for other ones like them to protect them. And so they don't get outed and all that kind of stuff. So there's fiction, but there's still sentences in there that maybe just make you think. And I would imagine Bifurcation Events has things along those lines. I know you've referenced Ernest Hemingway as being one of your heroes. She wrote a blog about that. I can put that in the show notes because I think it's worth reading. So if you took me back to school, so I'm not trying to go back to English class all the time because I was clearly traumatized by what happened in English class. If you made me read Ernest Hemingway and then gave me a test on it, I don't know what I would have done, right? It wouldn't have been a big deal, but it wouldn't have hit me. So then I had this opportunity to take my daughter. We went to Europe. And we went to London and we went to Paris. She's been studying French since she's been a little girl. And it's been a dream of hers to go there to speak French with people from France, right? And just go and like life. So I pick up A Movable Feast, right? And then to walk the streets, again, times have changed and Paris looks very different than when he was there, I'm sure. But the cafes are still there. One of the restaurants he went to is not there. Gertrude Stein's apartment is there. It's even noted as we're walking down the street. I'm like, wait a second. I just read about this in his book. That's the street. And we look and like, there's the apartment complex. Anyway, like, that's different experience you have with that book, reading it now, being in the location. And like, and I have this totally different relationship. So I move on to The Old Man and the Sea. And again, these are stories that have like maybe nothing to do with like, I'm not a fisherman, right? I'm not going out there. I'm not anyway. But there's the lines in this. I don't know. I think it just makes you, I even experimented with a piece recently that you helped edit. It's just different, right? But it's fun. And it's, I don't know, it stretches your imagination and all that. But I'm going down this path of one of your heroes, Ernest Hemingway. And I'm sure you've read his books many times over.
Not all of them,
Not all of them. Well, right. But something there. So our experience in reading changes at different times, maybe based on location, based on when a book, someone will say, read this book. You have to read this book. Maybe. Or like when you're ready to receive it, or for some random reason, we pick up these books and I don't know, we maybe didn't have any expectations, or we thought maybe we had bad expectations and it like floored us. You can't be receptive to everything all the time. But sometimes it's something about a book where you pick it up, you're like, holy shit, right?
That's funny. I'm thinking of picking up Great Expectations again.
Yeah.
Now, they made me read it when I was 14 in English class. And, you know, I've read a lot of great books in English class or literature class during high school. The fact that I read something during English class for me is not a negative. That's where I got introduced to Hemingway. But Charles Dickens just didn't do it for me.
Yeah.
you know, like, okay, yeah, whatever. 20-year-old cake is going bad. Okay, whatever. But I'm currently on this William Tecumseh Sherman kick. If you don't know who he is, I mean, look him up. He's a big deal historical person. Be aware that a lot of the material you'll find about him at first is wrong, but you'll get, you know, sort of a, you know, you don't know who he is, that he's easy to find out about to some extent. Anyway, he loved Charles Dickens books. Like his letters, I've read a collection of his letters, and he's constantly making these unsignaled references to Charles Dickens books and other things. He was a complete bookworm. But the last thing he did before he died, you know, he was in his final illness and stuck in bed. And the last thing he did before he got so busy dying he couldn't do anything else was to start to reread Great Expectations. Maybe I ought to read that thing again.
Yeah.
Maybe there's something I missed.
Yeah. Do you reread a lot of books?
Yeah. There's a lot of books that I haven't reread.
Yeah.
There are books that I loved, 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 and haven't reread yet and don't really feel any urge to right now. Like Too Late the Phalarope. I read that when I was, I think, 17 in school. It was assigned. Loved that book. It was wonderfully written. Haven't been back to it.
Yeah.
Other things, you know, I've read A Wizard of Earthsea probably 15 times. And I keep finding more stuff in it.
Yeah.
A lot of Ursula K. Le Guin books I read multiple times. I read some Hemingway multiple times.
Yeah.
And I don't usually do it on purpose. I'll be like walking by a bookshelf and like, oh, time to read this again.
Yeah. Do you put books down? Do you stop in the middle?
Very rarely.
Okay.
I mean, I read a little bit compulsively.
Okay.
I sometimes read books even though I don't like them just because they're there and I started and now I have to finish.
Okay.
So for me to put a book down and not pick it back up again is very rare. I have done it. I did it with Lathe of Heaven. It's an Ursula K. Le Guin book. I tried reading it twice and both times it scared me out of my mind.
Yeah. Just had to put it down.
I walked away from it. I intend to read everything that Ursula K. Le Guin ever wrote. She's another hero of mine, at least everything she ever published, except Lathe of Heaven.
Yeah, exceptions.
And I don't think it's a bad book.
Right.
It's probably a very good book. Just scares the Jesus out of me. Okay, sorry.
I know, it's good. And maybe it's harder to do with fiction than nonfiction, because nonfiction could be looked at almost as like a series of blog posts in many regards. Right? Or you can just find a section. You could like, oh, this is the part that interests me. And it starts on page 150. Okay, cool. Then you go there. To a lot of people will start a book and they won't finish it because they're having a hard time for whatever reason to finish. Maybe they don't like the book, or maybe it's just too cumbersome. I don't know. Or they don't understand it. So they stop reading it, but they feel like I got to continue. So they just stick with that book. So it's almost like giving someone permission to be like, just put that book down and go get another book and possibly read multiple books at the same time. And I think that's freeing in many regards, especially this day and age when, you know, we all have books around us, you know, physical books, but there's also digital books. There's Audible, right? There's like so many different versions of, I use all three. I can make a case for any one of them at any time for different reasons. Physical's still my favorite, but I kind of like having an iPad and like, I could like go to multiple books at different times, like, I mean, within a couple hours. Anyway, I think that's been freeing to give yourself permission, almost like you said, give yourself permission to write badly. Give yourself permission to put the book down.
Oh, yeah.
And I think there's something to be said for, we want people to read. I think it's useful, right? I mean, if books have been around forever and someone's like, well, everything's going to video. I'm like, okay. Writing was like the earliest form of communication. Pictures and writing were the earliest forms of communication. Like all of a sudden that's just going to go away. Like people are producing books in mass right now. Like, and the classics haven't gone anywhere. Like they're still, yeah, I know some states are banning books, whatever. That's again, another topic for another political debate, but like reading and writing isn't going anywhere. So we want people to read and give them permission to read and to read what they're interested in. If you like comic books, read comic books, right?
Yeah.
I've heard this, read what you love until you love to read. I think that's great advice.
When I was in my early 20s, I was dating a man who was just, he thought he was stupid, and he wasn't. And he knew he wasn't. Like, he could admit in some conversations that he actually had above average intelligence.
Yeah.
And then in a different conversation, he'd be back to thinking he was stupid. You know, he just sort of stuck there. Mm. And one of the reasons he thought he was stupid was because he thought that intelligence meant reading, you know, classic literature and enjoying it and understanding it.
That's right.
And he just didn't. And I said, look, those books are classics because a lot of people like them. But a lot of people like the way skinny models look. You don't. You like curvier women. Does that mean there's something wrong with you for liking curvier women? And of course, he said no, because he was talking to me and I'm curvy and I was his girlfriend. But I think I got my point across.
You know, did. Yeah.
You read what you like. And if you don't like what you're supposed to like, so what? Now, I do think that there is something to be said for cultivating a taste. Mm. If we're, oh, all these people like this, maybe I should give it a shot. Maybe I should give it a second try. Maybe I should talk to them to find out what they like about it, and maybe I can learn to like it too. There's room for that.
Sure.
But there shouldn't be any room at all for, oh, I didn't like A Tale of Two Cities, therefore I'm stupid.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. It turns it off. That's possibly what happens in school for a lot of people, and they stop reading because they were just presented books that they didn't like at that time. That doesn't mean, like myself, they won't like those books at another point in time.
Right. And they were told, this is what it means to be smart. This is what it means to like reading.
Right. Correct.
And it isn't.
Yeah. What do you think? Again, huge topic. We just bring it up. AI. Mm-hmm. Writing, it's there. It's not going anywhere. There's good, there's bad. At this moment, right now, in this conversation, like, what do you think of AI as it relates to writing?
It's a tool.
Yeah.
Actually, I'm using an AI in my current book. You know, it doesn't do writing for me.
Right.
But playing around with it, I found a number of things that it's really good at. It's good at brainstorming. I don't usually use the ideas that it gives me. Sometimes I do. Usually I don't. But the ideas that it'll give me, you know, I get my ideas based on that. And then I write that.
And then you take it from there.
Or another thing that's really useful, yeah, I mentioned being on a William Tecumseh Sherman kick. Just the way my mind works, I get really super hyper-focused, preoccupied with whatever I'm into at the moment. And there is no human being on earth who can stand to talk about William Tecumseh Sherman as much as I want to talk about him right now.
Yeah.
But you know what? The AI doesn't get bored. It doesn't think I'm weird. It doesn't say, no more Sherman. You know?
Right.
So that's useful. I'm not afraid of AI. As a writer, I am afraid of some human beings using AI. Mm. You know, it's a tool. Just like a hammer is a tool. I'm not afraid of a hammer. If the wrong person picks up a hammer and comes at me, better believe I'd be afraid.
Yeah.
And AI is not regulated right now. There aren't clear ideas about what it can be used for, what it can't be used for. There are all kinds of other problems in the writing world right now that pre-exist AI and need their own separate solutions, but AI is just going to make them worse. So yeah, I'm very concerned about all of that. But AI itself, it's just a machine. It just sits there.
Yeah.
It does what it's told to do.
Yep.
Randall Monroe, he writes the internet comic XKCD, which if you haven't checked it out, do that. And he has a bunch of other books, you know, written, made of paper books.
Yeah.
And I think actually in one of his comics, not all of which are funny. I mean, some are, but not all of them are. Some of them are thought-provoking. One of his comics makes me cry every time I think too carefully about it. But anyways, there's this one of his where, you know, he makes a joke about killer robots. And in the rollover text, he says something like, "I'm not afraid of robots gaining power. I'm afraid of the people that robots give power to." And, you know, talk about lines. You were mentioning that people remember lines. Like, oh, yeah, that's exactly it. That's exactly it.
Yeah, it is. And that is a concern. I mean, I listened to a couple of things you talked earlier about pausing in between. Like, I had to think about some stuff. So I was listening to Sam Altman, who's the founder of OpenAI and ChatGPT-4 right now. And he pauses a lot to a point where you think, like, did the podcast just turn off? Like, you know, but you give that freedom to that individual. Like or hate Elon Musk, I mean, he's thinking a lot. As he's not just answering the question. I think there was one he did on the Lex Fridman podcast. He paused for 23 seconds. And the host, Lex Fridman, let him pause and think. And he got to his thought and reflected on it, talked about it. These are tools, and they are all concerned about this ending up in the wrong hands and what that would mean. Because like you said, the tool's amazing. Like, you're talking about your outlines earlier. You could feed it your 100 pages. And if it understood your thought process and how you wanted your outline to look, it could help you remind you of what your book's about. It could give you that outline. And not to say that you wouldn't want to do it as well, but it's just like so what do you think of it so far? And it is, it's unemotional. If you have an employee and you want them to write a piece and they write the piece and they come back like, this isn't good enough, they get upset. They do it again. They come back in there. It's like, yeah, you missed this. You didn't do that. Now you're dealing with emotions, you're dealing with drama, you're dealing with all this stuff. I'm not saying that we don't want to help this individual write, but the AI is unemotional about it.
Right.
Oh, you want to do it again? Let's go do it again. Unemotionally, not attached, all this kind of stuff. It's very unique. It's very interesting time. Like you said, it's a tool. Research, it doesn't mean the research is all going to be right. World building, right? Like, perhaps it could help in that. You have a line in a blog. It was more recently, because I know you've written more pieces about world building, which gets into your book, Bifurcation Events. And this hit me. So here's a sentence, right, that we've talked about before. "I only have to tell you what you need to hear." That's what you said. You've helped me with that as when I'm writing, because I could be a stream of consciousness if you didn't notice. My wife tells me that all the time. But I enjoy that. And so then I have to remember, okay, is this person on the other end of it, are they ready for my stream of consciousness? Is the reader, like, do they want that? Or is it just for me? Which is different, right? Because sometimes, like, I have to get it all out there. Sometimes it's just, we don't need to share all that information. And that's where a good editor comes in. And that's also, like, world building. Like, I was thinking, I have not seen the movies. I have not read these books, Dune 1, Dune 2. And those are books written, sci-fi movies, or sci-fi books written in the 60s, which I didn't even realize it was that long ago. And now the movies, the second movie, is like considered one of the best sci-fi movies of all time. Again, have not seen it, have no opinion on it. My one daughter did go see the first one with friends. I don't think she watched the whole thing, and she says it was so boring, she hated it. They like had to leave. Anyway, talk about world building that they must, I've read about it. Like, what's it about? What's the story about? The world building they must do in those novels and in even the movies has got to be just unbelievable. I mean, they're creating all sorts of stuff. That's a lot to do as a writer, to like, somehow get the words across, because you could create so much and next thing you know, you've lost the reader. They're like, I have no idea where this is going. So I only have to tell you what you need to hear.
Yeah.
That's a big thought that you have. And I know you've done that with your editing, and you've obviously done it with your books.
Yeah. It's hard because, you know, I made up all this stuff. I want to share it. It's so great. The reader doesn't need to know.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I'm not sure, does the reader need to know this particular thing? Is this important to the story I'm trying to tell? Do I keep it? Do I not? Now, the parts that don't get included, they're still important. Just like the parts of your train of thought that don't end up in the blog post or the essay are still important. They have to be there to make the parts that do show up happen. It's just whether the reader actually needs to be able to see them.
That part that you just said right there, that's huge. That's for someone like myself or anybody that's writing, talking, because it helps you get to that point, perhaps, mm-hmm. right? It is part of the story, but you didn't need to share it all.
Yeah.
Think of like music. You don't want to, like, people can interpret it how they want to interpret it. It's not up to you to tell them how to interpret it. It kind of gets boring if everyone tells you, here's what to think. Like, no. Like, I want to think for myself. And I've even heard, I don't know who it is, story about, it was like a love story. And everyone was blown away by this individual's song. And then he went up on stage one time and he explained what the song was about. And everyone's like, ah, oh, it was about his cat. But they had this whole interpretation that it was about something else. People want to interpret it how they want to interpret it. But anyway, going back to the whole, it's important. Then it validates your thoughts, but it doesn't mean it has to be out there.
Right.
I think that's empowering is what that is to those words.
Yeah, I used to think my thought process when I'm trying to figure something out, you know, I'll go from point A to point B to point, you know, this whole train of thought that, you know, I bounce all over the place. And that's how I get to, you know, this new understanding that I want to share with the reader. And I used to think that the best way to share this understanding with the reader, whatever it was to share with them the journey of how I got there. And I realized a lot of the time it isn't, because people have different mental processes and the way I come to an understanding might be different than how somebody else does. So when I want to share an idea with a reader, I'm thinking, okay, what's the best way to just explain this idea to the reader? Never mind how I got there. But the fact that I got there the way that I got there is still important, because I wouldn't have gotten there otherwise, you know?
Yeah.
It's like footprints. You know, you're following a track of footprints, maybe. And footprint, 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 footprint. That doesn't mean that, you know, the legs of the animal that made the footprint aren't important. They're not in the trackway. But you know, the trackway wouldn't be there if the rest of the animal hadn't been.
Yeah. Very useful. Bifurcation events.
Yes.
The book's out. It'll be out on Amazon soon. Very soon.
Yeah.
I think I'll read your blurb before this episode starts. So in the final recording, they'll have heard the blurb before.
Okay, good.
Because it's really good. It got me excited about the book, honestly.
Good. Blurbs are so hard.
Yeah, they are very hard. And I believe this character showed up in your previous book.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And now we're expanding upon it. So mm-hmm. Tell us about this character, this book, this world.
Well, my previous book, Ecological Memory, had two main protagonists, Elsie and Andy. Elsie's mostly the viewpoint character, but Andy's actually more central to the story. It's more about him in a lot of ways. They're both in this new book. Again, Elsie is usually the viewpoint character, and there's a few other characters who come in. Elsie has a boyfriend now, and she has a dog, and, you know, just there's a lot more detail now. But yeah, I got curious about what else was going on for Andy. So the other stories in this book are other people who have some sort of connection to him. And in some cases, like the character Penny, the reader has no way of knowing what the connection that she has to Andy is. And I'm not going to say what it is publicly. That's going to come out in some future book. But this world, they're both set in the same world. It is after our civilization falls apart because of a pandemic, actually. But our civilization falls apart and this new one, this new civilization starts to develop. And so most of these characters are either lived through the transition and remember it as Andy does, or they grew up kind of in its shadow, Yeah, so it's very transitional time in history between these two civilizations. And in this book, we get into that more. You know, there are stories that are focused on the disease, you know, people living through it and having it and what that was like and what the collapse of civilization was like and how that worked and why that happened and how different people survived because they were surviving in different ways. So there's this main story where Elsie and her boyfriend are trying to figure out why he, Kevin, the boyfriend, has nightmares about a forest fire that happened in 1947 that he wasn't alive then, and he didn't even know that it happened. So why is he having nightmares about it? So they have to figure this out. And Andy comes in, and it becomes this detective story involving, you know, history and genealogy and the local history of Mount Desert Island in Maine. And then there are all of these other stories that show this world from these other perspectives. Like there's Andy's uncle, who is kind of an awful human being. I mean, he tries, but... When you read Luke's story, if you find him offensive, that's kind of on purpose. He's supposed to be. He gets better, kind of.
Yeah.
So you get to see how Luke lived through this transition and how it changed his life and his approach and how Penny lived through it and how she ended up accidentally helping invent a new religion. And there's one story where we get to see Elsie as a child, as a six-year-old girl who's sick and in a tent and just trying to figure out what's going on. So it's the same world, and it's some of the same stories and themes, some of the same characters that we saw before, but it's just more detail, more perspective, more different angles.
Yeah. I like how you have, we talked about before, relationships with books, with writing, reading, with your characters. Mm-hmm. As I've talked to more authors, and they talk about the characters in their book, like you put your hand on your head when you were talking about these characters with Luke, I believe.
Yeah.
I think that's so cool. I love it. So, like I said before, Bifurcation Events, it'll be available. Caroline, where can we read more? I found your blog. Mm-hmm. I've read your blogs because you've provided a lot of your blogs with us. Where can people learn and read more about you? Where can they find this book? Where can they find your other books and anything else that's out there?
Well, all of my books are available at my publisher's website, Saltwater Media. It's saltwatermedia.com, something like that.
Yeah, we'll put in the show notes too.
Yeah. And all of them except this one are on Amazon. This one will be on Amazon soon.
Yep.
There's just a delay in that process, but it'll be there. I have my website, newsfromcaroline.wordpress.com, and that's where I share my thoughts on writing. It's also where I announce when I've got a new thing published and
yeah,
that sort of thing. And I'm the only Caroline Alanthus in the world, so I'm easy to Google.
Yes. It's a strategic advantage, I think.
And I didn't do it on purpose. I mean, that's my real name.
Right. Right. Caroline, this is great. I've learned a lot. Like the footprint story you just told recently, that sticks with me. There's gonna be a lot more. I'm going to have to go back. Like a good book, I'm going to have to go back and re-listen to this many times. But I always enjoy talking to you. Always thoughtful, excited about your new book, Bifurcation Events. And yeah, you've taught me a lot when it comes to writing and given a lot of pathways to explore different areas of writing.
Good.
And to allow myself, and I know others who have been impacted by it as well, to write badly.
Good.
To just write. So thank you. And I've enjoyed our conversation today.
I do.
In case you haven't noticed, we love podcasts. In fact, we love building podcasts, everything from development to production. Because of all that, we're building a one-of-a-kind podcast network. If you have a podcast or looking to launch a new podcast, then we should talk. You can message me on Twitter at @Eric_Kaz or hit us up any way that works for you. Let's talk about your podcast joining this one-of-a-kind podcast network.